Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. It's late November. Holiday season is nearly upon us. If you're thinking about gifts that can tug at your heartstrings, I have such a book for you. My guest today, journalist and author Maria Gudovich, has a new book out called Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. This is on the heels of her previous books about dogs, including Soldier Dogs, Secret Service Dogs, and the bestseller Top Dog about Luca, a Marine Service dog who became a hero. In this latest book, Gudovich teaches us about dogs' incredible smelling ability and their genuine joy and compassion in working with companions for a variety of medical reasons. Today, there are trained dogs who can sense when a companion with diabetes has a blood sugar that is too high or too low. There are dogs who can smell cancer before it's ever diagnosed, and there are dogs who can detect antibiotic-resistant bacteria. In the world of mental health, service dogs have changed the lives of families with children on the autism spectrum, in addition to providing anticipatory support and guidance to people suffering with various forms of anxiety, including post-traumatic stress disorder. It's really an amazing set of stories. Maria Gudovich, author of Dr. Dogs, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Maria Gudovich, welcome to Medical Monday. The new book, Dr. Dogs, what led you to pursue this topic?
Well, I've been writing about dogs and how they use their sense of smell to protect people, their sense of smell and really the bond they have with their handlers. I've been writing about military dogs and Secret Service dogs for many years now. And it was sort of a natural next step because I started hearing about dogs who are detecting cancer in laboratory settings, in scientific settings, really, around the world. And it was a new thing when I started hearing about it. And I thought, you know, there may be something to this. And doctor dogs in my book, literally in my book, are the dogs who are on the cutting edge of medicine. So they're either working in research or right beside someone to save their life every day. And really, the doctor dogs are, for the most part, using their incredible sense of smell to detect these diseases. And then if they're paired with a person, their bond with that person to tell them, you know, something that will save their life.
Yeah, I mean, it really is incredible. And I guess I have seen a few news stories about things like this, but so I just didn't realize the extent of it. And your reporting for this book really did take you all over the world.
Yes, I did go around the world. The first Dr. Dogs I really read about initially was in the Japan Times. I happened to read it, and they were in Japan. And the doctor who was working with them was very hospitable. And there's a village north of Tokyo, about 5 hours north of Tokyo, where they're doing some research on a town that has a very high level of stomach cancer. And he welcomed me to come along, and I got some really, you know, really good scenes for the book and great information. And you know, all through Europe and the United States, because really this is all fairly new and a lot of it hadn't made the news at that point. And so I just wanted to find the best of the best cutting edge medical dogs around the world. And it was really fun to see them working with their people and how good they are. They're incredibly good at detecting disease.
Yeah, and so you mentioned the Japanese community with stomach cancer. You also reported on a dog that could detect ovarian cancer, which had sort of a personal connection for you.
Yes, actually, this is a book. I have skin in this game. I really have ovaries in this game, actually, because unfortunately, we have ovarian cancer in the family. My mom died of it, and some other relatives on that side of the family have died of ovarian cancer. And as you probably know, there's not much great testing for early detection. And it turns out, I heard about these dogs at the University of Pennsylvania Working Dog Center, Veterinary Working Dog Center, and they are able, it's not just one, it's a few of them, they're being trained on ovarian cancer, and they're able to detect it as early as stage one. Now, this is not, we're not even talking tumors here, we're talking, what they're detecting in it is blood, not just blood, but the plasma, which is just one portion of the blood, you know, it's the yellow part of the blood if you separate it out. And so they're able to detect, get this, they're able to detect ovarian cancer in one drop of plasma from a woman with ovarian cancer, and yet they're not alerting, they don't alert to a drop of plasma from a woman with a benign ovarian tumor. There is a difference. They've been trained on this cancer, and they know just what they're sniffing out. So they're, picture a cat, like a giant wheel on its side, and the dogs are going around it. It's like a carousel with ports on the end, and each port has a sample of something or another, and the dogs are really, really good at detecting ovarian cancer in this setting. And they're really, this is one of the best places in the world because they're up on the latest best practices. And the fact that the dogs can do this is exciting to me. And I think for so many people who have hard to detect cancers in the family. What the dogs are doing now is remarkable, and it's because their sense of smell is so keen. They can sniff in parts per trillion. They can detect a tablespoon of a substance, like a packet, like really a packet of sugar in two Olympic-sized swimming pools, that size difference. And we have 6 million olfactory receptors, and they have up to 300 million. So their noses are really primed, and it's a matter of just training them, and it's all really positive training. These dogs in these laboratories, these research centers, are usually they're pet dogs who come in. They're screened to see if they could do this job pretty well, and they do it all for praise and treats or toys in the case of Pennsylvania. And they're just they want to work, and they love finding things and getting praise for it or getting their rewards. So their paycheck is everything. They don't know that they might be helping save lives one day. Now, this is not a screening. Screening is hard to do with dogs because dogs need that paycheck. So in Japan, where they screened a village that had high rates of stomach cancer, it was harder because the dogs, no one knew which ones to reward them for because, again, they don't know if these people have cancer. So that presented some challenges, which makes researchers realize dogs are a stepping stone. They are just one really important part in the way for science to eventually figure out what they're smelling. They're the volatile organic compounds.
VOCs, yes.
VOCs, yes. And I have VOCs around the book for a lot of diseases, but cancer is maybe the most important because we don't know what the dogs are smelling. I should say the scientists don't know what it is the dogs are smelling. They're trying to figure it out. And they don't even know if all cancers have one VOC or if each one has its own unique fingerprint. It could be a whole bunch. It could be a pattern of VOCs. They don't know. So they're trying to work with the dogs with a technology called, various chemical analysis technologies. One of them is GCMS, and if you're going to make me say that, gas chromatography, magnetic spectrometry.
Very
and
good.
The scientists, the researchers are giving the dogs the scent to say, okay, is this the part of it? And the dogs will say, no, I'm not alerting to that, or, something familiar here. And it's a feedback loop. And so eventually the scientists hope that they will be able to discover the VOCs of cancer, various cancers, and in the not-too-distant future, we'll be able to go to our doctor's office and have something called an ENOS, a very non-invasive, easy test that's hopefully highly accurate. And maybe I would go in and I would blow into a tube, and it could analyze my breath, because that's one thing that dogs are able to sniff cancer on is breath. It just depends on the type of cancer. So there may be these really easy, inexpensive technologies that are born from these dogs who are doing this. And they're also doing this with Parkinson's. I just got back from San Juan Island off Washington State, where I gave a talk about my book. But I also got to see these dogs at work, multiple dogs at work, sniffing for Parkinson's. They're trying to sniff it out really early. And they're trying to find the volatile organic compounds that might be there in the early stages of Parkinson's that might be a really, really good screening tool in the future once they come up with that technology.
And Maria, we talked a little bit about cancer and the volatile organic compounds. Another area that dogs have proven possibly even more beneficial, because in the clinical world, they're out really doing this for patients with diabetes. This was something you really educated me about in this book. I mean, talk about a feel-good set of stories. I mean, you have several people you report on and talk about the dogs and how the dogs literally have saved their lives from people getting hypoglycemic, having low blood sugar, and these dogs will just be able to smell it quite literally and then nudge either their caregiver, their patient, or someone in the family to kind of alert them.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the same thing, we don't know what the dogs are smelling, but the trainers are training the dogs on the scent of hypoglycemia and also hyperglycemia, sometimes low and high blood sugar, but low is the one that most of them are training them on initially. So actually when I went to a research center, it's called Dogs for Diabetics, they're actually training these dogs. They do a great job. They're in Northern California. And I went there and they actually swiped my back with a piece of gauze because I'm not diabetic, so they just wanted a control. What they do with the gauze is they'll put it in the freezer and they have gauze swipes from the skin of other people who are in a diabetic low, and they are training the dogs to smell that low. And whatever it is, we don't know. And the dogs have to sort it out. The dogs are so smart, and it's not just one exposure. They need so many exposures to this to have that aha moment like, what is that commonality? What is it that they are smelling in each of these samples? Because everybody smells different. And we have so many scents on us, so many of these volatile organic compounds that can get swept up with a piece of gauze, or sometimes they use saliva. And the dogs are somehow able to put it together, and then they're with their person who has diabetes, and they are usually able to tell the person 15, maybe sometimes 20 minutes before the person's devices even say, hey, you're going into a low, because the dogs detect this in real time, whereas the monitors detect it in a different way that takes a longer time. So that gives the person that extra bit of time to do what they need to do, take glucose or whatever. And another really life-saving property of these dogs is that they often can wake up and smell their person going into a low. Now, when someone is sleeping and they hit a diabetic low and they're going lower and lower, they could die. They could go into a coma. They could die. So these dogs are alerting them, or if it's a child, they'll alert the parent. But the dogs can wake the person up. They stand on their chest. They do whatever it takes to make the person wake up. And I wrote about this in the book, but it's utterly life-saving. And the dogs are so devoted, and it's super cute to watch them. They sometimes will grab on to something called a bringsel, which is a tube that hangs off their collar, and they just look so earnestly at their person, and they're just saying, "Come on, we've got this. You know, let's get up. Let's do this. Let's take your glucose. Do what it takes." Because these dogs see what happens when it doesn't happen, and they're so devoted to their people. After a while, they know that they're doing something important. The ones in the laboratories, that's probably for rewards and treats, but the ones who are at home for diabetes or seizures, they're in it for their person too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really amazing, and it adds that whole other layer of the dogs having had this repetitive training with treats and praise, but then when they get out in kind of the real world setting, how they're able to adapt even further on their own, you know, through their intelligence. And you tell the story of Clay Ronk and his family, this young man who was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic and unfortunately became diabetic, went into a coma, and that was how it was discovered. And you focus on the family's figuring out essentially that a service dog might be possible for them, but how they didn't want to get their hopes up too high and actually sort of borrowed a temporary dog that wound up becoming their actual dog. But how is it that, how accurate do they have to be before these groups that train these dogs will kind of let them go home with somebody?
Yeah, the one Clay got from Dogs for Diabetics, they have to be 80% accurate, which is, most of them are way, way above that. But the minimum to graduate, and the person has to be able to read the dog and everything, but they have to be 80%, and they're usually, you know, 90%, 95%. They're really, really good at what they do. But, you know, dogs are only human. They do miss things. They get distracted. They get tired. Maybe they get a cold. So they're not perfect, but most of the people I spoke with and interviewed for the book, or, you know, who didn't even make it into the book, said their dog has never missed one. So, and I think they just get better with time. And a lot of the organizations, the good ones, will continue to have the person come in, have the dog tested, make sure everything is, you know, the training continues. And I do want to say, I want to give a heads up, because there are a lot of really reputable organizations doing this, and there are trainers who are trying, and maybe they're not so good, and then there are some scam organizations, so you've really got to do your homework. If, you know, just anyone who's looking for any kind of doctor dog has to really, really, really do homework. Look for more than one or two examples of these dogs, and buyer beware. And these dogs are usually often given for free. Sometimes they're charged. But there have been some cases where people have been very disappointed after, you know, raising or spending a lot of money. So,
yeah, and you do a good job of making that clear kind of early on in the book, and saying that, you know, you really do have to be a buyer beware. But also make the point of, you know, it's a whole nother book to talk about this whole thing about emotional support animals. I mean, these are service dogs who are very specifically trained for a single purpose, and this does not really go into that territory. One thing you mentioned, you talk about a dog might get tired, or, you know, would not want to play, or what have you, or have a cold or something. I was interested to learn that the trainers taught you that even smoking near a dog can really impact its sense of smell and its ability to do this diagnostic work. Yeah. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, actually, some organizations will not give or sell or whatever a dog to someone who has a smoker in the home. I have not read any studies. I don't know if there have been any studies done about canine olfaction with smoke, but people have anecdotal evidence that it can really affect their noses, especially over time. In fact, in the wildfires we've been having up here in Northern California, there are a lot of service dogs in the Santa Rosa, California area that has been hit year after year by fire, and I'm talking doctor dogs, service dogs, and there people try to get as far away from the smoke as possible, mostly just to preserve the dog's sense of smell. Again, that's nothing that there has been a study on, but there's a doctor I wrote about in the book, Dr. Wolf, and he noticed that his dog, he's diabetic, and he has his dog come into the office with him, and his dog goes into every room, every examining room with him, as long as the person's okay with the dog being there. But he noticed his dog was not alerting. His dog was just not alerting. And same with some seizure dogs, some people who have seizure dogs. If it's super, super hot sometimes, the dogs have a problem because their priority is breathing at that point and not smelling. But, you know, then again, you have more dogs. You have these military dogs in Iraq, Afghanistan, sniffing out bombs in 110 degrees, and they're doing a good job. Some of it is acclimation, but the smoke really is a concern for a lot of people.
Another use of dogs that you write about that I thought was really interesting, because this is definitely something we come across in medical journalism a lot, is this idea of superbugs. These are resistant bacteria or other microorganisms that are resistant to our conventional antibiotics. And I was fascinated to learn that dogs may have a role here as well.
Yes, actually, there's one dog in Vancouver who is working in a hospital now, and he's beyond research. His name's Angus, and there are now three or four of these dogs who are sniffing out C. diff, Clostridium difficile, which is one of those superbugs that can easily spread in vulnerable populations and hospitals, and you know it manifests in horrible diarrhea and all kinds of issues that can actually kill people. And these dogs are stopping it in its tracks, and they found that where the dogs are, the rates of C. diff really diminished. I hung out at a hospital one day and I just watched Angus do his rounds, and he found what seemed to be definite C. diff. He was so certain about the C. diff, and he made sure his person stopped. And before I knew it, they had a whole cleaning team. They do ultraviolet cleaning, and someone said there was a brown streak. Now, you know, it spread through feces, so they were cleaning that in the way that would just not spread it. Part of the reason he's so good at what he does also is because people know he's going to be making the rounds, and so they're extra careful not to throw their dirty gloves so that they'll land on the floor, and they're just using best practices. But beyond that, there are a number of other superbugs that they are trying to figure out. And in addition to malaria, dogs have been able to sniff malaria on the socks of children from the Gambia in Africa. And right now, they're doing a preliminary study in Africa at checkpoints. So this is just beginning, actually, where the dogs are at checkpoints where people are coming into a country, and the country they're coming into may have a very low or non-existent rate of malaria, and they want to keep it that way. And we're going to see if the dogs are able to sniff it as it's passing by. And it's just another level of screening. So the dogs are, where there's a superbug, there's probably a smell. And where there's a smell, a dog can be deployed. And so it's just in this really beginning phases of this really exciting process that dogs might be part of. And they might even be able to stop an epidemic from becoming a pandemic in the future. Some people even talk about Ebola and dogs being able to detect that. And there's just a lot of excitement. And there's a scientist I interviewed at MIT. He does all kinds of research. And he's a firm, firm believer in the power of a dog's nose to stop these superbugs. And even lethal agents, bioterrorism, anything that And of course, keeping the dog safe, that's the concern as well.
Yeah, it's just absolutely amazing. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Maria Gudovich. She is a veteran journalist and author of the new book, Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. And I wanted to make sure I mentioned that there's some gorgeous color plates in the book where you know, many of the pictures, I should say, that you took yourself.
Yeah.
You get a lot of credit, which are really nice.
Thank you.
One of the things that led me to wonder, first of all, you share with us, of course, your own dog, Gus, a beautiful yellow lab who apparently loves smells himself. He's not medically trained, but he seems to adore getting into any foul-smelling thing he can.
Yes. In fact, this morning we were in Golden Gate Park, and I'm borrowing his sister. His sister lives in San Francisco also. So we often, you know, have slumber parties. And they were wandering through the park. And next thing I see, he's rolling in something. So I had to come back, and I think it was coyote poop
this time.
But it can be worse. There are homeless people in the park, and he has been known to roll in stuff that they make. But mostly, it's usually horse poop or coyote poop. And I feel like he just wants to, dogs supposedly do this in order to sort of become, camouflage themselves, disguise themselves. But he looks so proud when he's part horse, part coyote, and these other dogs come up to him, and he really seems like a rock star to them, and he holds himself really proudly, and they are sniffing him, especially the young ones. They just think he's a god of all animals or something. That's what it appears. Who knows why he's really doing it? He is not a doctor dog, but he has an excellent nose, and actually I'm going to be starting to do some nose work with him here in the city soon.
Oh, very nice. Well, it made me wonder, the plates and many of the dogs you talk about, certainly not all of them, but many of them do seem to be labs. So is it just that labs are such good smellers and good work dogs and are able to kind of be trained really well? I mean, they're definitely not all labs, but it just seems like maybe, is that the preponderance?
Yeah,
or is that
so what it is, the labs, yes, there are mostly labs that you'll see as service dogs working beside people. Partly because they have good noses, but also because they're really good. They love to work for a reward or treat, and they've been bred for so long as service dogs, or even hunter dogs who work with us, and that's just their personality, to want to please, to want to eat. But really, any dog who has a focus and a decent nose, which most of them do, can do the work. The dogs that I've seen in research are a great variety of dogs. So those dogs can be absolutely labs and often are, but I've seen everything from, actually, in my trip to Washington State, I met my little friend Suga, who is a Pomeranian, and she wears a tutu, and she's a diva, and she's hilarious, and she sniffs out Parkinson's disease like no one. And there's also a big Vizsla who almost does somersaults when he's going around the scent wheel for Parkinson's, and German Shepherds, mixes, all kinds of Terriers, Cocker Spaniels. So I've seen a great variety in the laboratory setting where perhaps the companionship level and the calmness level is not as essential as it is for a doctor dog who's at your side for diabetes, seizures, sleep disorders, or what have you.
Yeah. Well, let's shift gears here a little bit. And part of the book, you spend talking about how doctor dogs can help people who have different forms of mental illness. And I found this fascinating, too. And you have a whole chapter devoted to people with autism and are on the autism spectrum and how dogs are helpful here. Can you share a couple of examples with us?
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Now, sometimes these dogs may be using their nose. Sometimes they're just being highly observant, as dogs are. They watch our body language all the time. But there are more and more dogs being used for mostly children on the spectrum, and they are remarkable. They can usually tell ahead of time when a child is about to have a tremendous amount of anxiety, panic, meltdown, or what have you, because of too much stimulation. And the dogs are there. They'll lean into the child. The child will sit down, and the dog will lie across their lap, or they'll lie down in the middle of the grocery aisle. The parent might get the child somewhere safe, and the dog will snuggle with the child. Some dogs are used to keep a child from bolting. That's kind of controversial, actually, because the dog is tethered to the child. And I go through what some of the good protocol for that would be if people are going to do that. But there are a lot of people who don't recommend that. But the dogs come in, and they often change the lives, not just of the child, but of the whole family, because the family has a really hard time, it just as the child does, with what's going on with autism. So there was a family I wrote about in Minnesota, a sweet boy who waited for 4 years to get a service dog, to get a doctor dog for his autism spectrum disorder. He was not able to go to restaurants. The family, therefore, couldn't go to restaurants. He couldn't travel. He could barely leave the house. He did go to school, but that was tough, too. And so they waited 4 years. They tried to get a regular pet dog in the meantime, thinking, oh, well, just, it's a dog. It'll work. But it was a disaster. It did not work at all as a service dog. So they got this dog named Lloyd. As soon as Lloyd came, he is a big black lab. As soon as he came into the life of the family, as soon as the boy met him, the boy started crying. The mother had never seen him cry tears of joy. And right there, boom, everything changed. Lloyd is this super calm presence. He's able to be with the boy and change him. The boy could not go to the barber's and get a haircut before. His hair was a shaggy mess. after Lloyd, all he has to do is just have his hand on Lloyd's head. Something about Lloyd is so calming. And same with doctors, dentists. And now they're traveling. They go in planes. They've been all over the United States. And the boy and Lloyd like to have their own table at restaurants. Now, it's a 180. He was a miracle for this family. And the same with so many dogs that I've heard about, talked about, and written about. There's another family in Croatia. I was lucky enough to be there on the day this girl was getting paired with her autism service dog. And the joy that this dog brought the family, just walking in. Again, the dog has changed the life of everyone in the family. The girl didn't have quite the same symptoms as the boy, but she's much more focused. He's helping her with homework. She has some learning difficulties, and so they are able to train him to bring the calendar or bring the ball that has the numbers or wear this color that means autumn, and these are the autumn months, and he'll bring over flags of different colors. He's really helping in so many ways, as well as the calming ways.
Well, another different example, those are amazing stories, actually, is on the anxiety spectrum, and specifically in post-traumatic stress disorder with people who've suffered through natural disasters, but also, of course, soldiers. So that's another way in which Dr. Dogs have been extremely therapeutic for people suffering from those kinds of conditions.
Yeah, a lot of people probably have heard about dogs for PTSD because there are more and more out there. There are more people from the military, more veterans and active duty even, who are suffering from PTSD and who have gotten these dogs, who, again, have been game changers. They save lives. I've talked to so many people who said, you know, if it weren't for my dog, I wouldn't be here. And not just the pet dogs. Pet dogs are great. And they can do many of the same things. But one of the dogs I wrote about was placed with a soldier who had been to Iraq twice. He had PTSD, and his life was falling apart. His marriage was falling apart, his health, everything. It just, he was on a cocktail of drugs. It made him a zombie. He hated that feeling. And one day someone told him about these dogs for PTSD. He ended up getting one. And again, the dog, his wife, now they have a really good marriage now, and his stable dad, he's working, he's only on one or two meds. And his wife calls his dog his second wife, his other wife, because he just has to say, if he's feeling anxious, he'll say, like, snuggle. And the dog will just come in for a big hug, or there are various commands. This dog knows 110 or 120 commands, not all related to that. He can open the fridge. He can do a number of things. Some dogs can sense ahead of time when someone is going to have anxiety or panic from PTSD or just anxiety. People are, there's so much more anxiety disorders right now, and there are dogs who are being trained on the scent of anxiety. There's a researcher and trainer in Indiana who has a refrigerator and freezer full of emotions. And she, as I was talking about with the diabetics, she swabs, or she'll have someone who's going through panic, anxiety, anger, fear, swab themselves with the gauze or cotton, and also spit into another cotton pad, and they'll mail them in or bring them in, train the dogs on these scents. So the dog can tell ahead of time. Now, dogs can tell ahead of time a lot of time if it's going to hit the fan for someone. But these dogs just get that extra boost of training. And what it is beyond the scent, it could be body language. It could be so many things that we don't even know yet. But the dogs are absolutely life-saving in these situations.
The name of the book is Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. And it's by my guest today, Maria Gudavich, who is a veteran journalist and author of several other books about selective dogs. Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.